You're all set up there, right?
Well, hello everybody, I hope you can hear me. This is the cover of a book that I wrote a few years ago, and by an astounding coincidence, it has exactly the same title as today's lecture. Let's start with some myths about energy. The first one is that $4 a gallon is too much to pay for gasoline. We used to pay $4 a gallon. We will pay $4 a gallon again in the future, but right now we pay a lot less. But at $4 a gallon, that's about $1 a liter. We pay twice that much for bottled drinking water. At $4 a gallon, gasoline would be the cheapest, just about the cheapest liquid you could buy in the United States, and that's a big part of the problem. Oil companies produce oil. They say they produce oil, they talk about production, rate of production, and so on. In fact, no oil company ever produced a drop of oil. Oil was produced by the earth and the sun over hundreds of millions of years, and the oil company simply extract it and sell it, and that's why it's so cheap. We must conserve energy, otherwise we'll have an energy crisis. The law of conservation of energy is one of the deepest laws in all of physics. Energy is always conserved no matter what we do. We don't need to conserve energy. There are things that we ought to conserve that call fuel. When we run out of oil, the marketplace will ensure that it's replaced by something else. We will look carefully at that part of the argument in the course of today's lecture. There's enough fossil fuel in the ground to last for hundreds of years. We'll look carefully at that as well. Nuclear energy is dangerous. At least many people think it's dangerous. Most technically trained people understand that nuclear energy is the most dependable and source of energy we have, but it will not solve our problems, as I'll try to tell you later on. The greenhouse effect and global warming are bad. I believe that without the greenhouse effect and global warming, we would not be alive. So we'll get to all of that in the course of today's lecture. So let's start with a brief history of energy. In the 18th century, there was something called caloric. It was a substance, a fluid contained in every body. If you had a hot piece of copper, you knew exactly how much caloric it contained. If you put the hot piece of copper into a pail of cold water, you could calculate how much caloric would run out of the copper into the water, and thereby predict accurately the temperature at which the two would come to equilibrium. So it was a precise mathematical theory, but not everyone was convinced. In particular, Count Rumford, Sir Benjamin Thompson, who was born in New Hampshire in 1753, doubted the theory. He pointed out that in the boring out of cannon barrels, a great deal of caloric was produced out of nothing, and that should not have been possible according to the caloric theory. And he even made an attempt to measure how much mechanical action was equivalent to a given amount of heat, but he was not successful in that. The law of conservation of energy was discovered at least 9 separate times between Rumford and its eventual discoverer. When something like that happens, the credit for making the discovery goes not to the person who discovered it first, but to the person who discovered it last, because he discovered it so well that it never had to be discovered again. His name was James Prescott Joule. Joule did an experiment in which 4-pound weights were lifted 16 feet above the ground and made to descend while turning a paddle wheel in a horizontal can of water. And then they replaced the weights and they descended one after another until 16 of them had descended. And then he measured the temperature of the water with a sensitive thermometer. He averaged the result of that experiment with 3 other similar sorts of experiments. And he reported to the Royal Society of London that the amount of heat required to raise 1 gallon of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit was equivalent to the amount of work required to lift 800 pounds through 1 foot. And that constituted the law of conservation of energy, the discovery of the law of conservation of energy. There are various forms of energy. There's kinetic energy, which can be organized like the energy of a car rolling down the street or a bowling ball rolling down the alley. And there's also the random motion of the atoms and molecules that make up the car or the bowling ball. The kinetic energy of the random motions of atoms and molecules inside of a body is directly proportional to its absolute temperature. So when the absolute temperature gets hotter, it just means that the molecules are moving around faster. Then there's potential energy, gravitational potential energy of the kind that he endowed his weights with when, with Joule endowed his weights with when they descended 16 feet. There's chemical potential energy, nuclear potential energy, and so on. There is one other form of energy that's important to our story, and that is radiant energy. If the form in which energy reaches the Earth from the Sun over 93 million miles of practically nothing at all. This plot has on its vertical plot is intensity and the horizontal plot is frequency. Low frequency waves are radio waves, infrared is medium. There's a narrow range of frequencies that form the visible, and beyond that there's ultraviolet and x-rays and gamma rays. The lowest curve on this graph is a curve of a warm body. Everybody always radiates energy at all wavelengths. And how much energy you radiate at which wavelength depends on your temperature. The lowest curve represents a relatively cool body. It might be your own body. It rises to a maximum deep in the infrared and then declines down to zero before it reaches the visible. You don't glow in the dark because you're just too cool. The middle curve represents a hotter body. It also has a maximum in the infrared, but it comes down through the visible, highest at the red end, so it glows red, it's red to the eye. That might be the temperature of an ember in the fireplace. The top curve is the temperature of the sun, and by no accident whatsoever, it has a maximum right near the visible. Our eyes evolved to be most sensitive to the color of sunlight as it reflects from the objects around us. Knowing that much, we can talk about the thermal properties of the Earth-Sun system. The sun is warmed by internal nuclear reactions to a temperature of about 6,000 kelvins and radiates uniformly white light in all directions. 93 million miles away, a tiny amount of that white light reaches the Earth, where 30% of it is reflected and 70% of it is absorbed. The 30% that's reflected looks like this. This is a picture of the Earth taken from the moon, and you see the colors of the continents and the seas and the clouds. The 70% that's absorbed must be re-radiated back out into space, otherwise the Earth would be warming up, and it's not. It's in a kind of equilibrium. It's a very simple calculation to figure out what temperature the Earth would need to radiate that 70% of the incident energy back into space. And the answer to that is 255 kelvins, or minus 18 degrees Celsius, or 0 degrees Fahrenheit. If the mean temperature of the Earth were minus 18 degrees Celsius, I don't believe we would be alive. So the story has to be more complicated than that. The Earth's climate is governed by a number of factors. One of them is the tilted axis. When the Earth is here at position A, the axis is pointed like that, and the northern hemisphere is pointed towards the sun, and it's summer in the north. 6 months later, when the Earth is at position C, the axis is still pointed in the same direction because the Earth is a gyroscope. And now the south is pointed towards the sun, and so it's summer in the south. So the tilted axis governs the seasons. The El Nino cycle is particularly interesting. The trade winds blow the water across the equatorial Pacific, piling up the warm, sun-warmed water against the Asian continent, where it evaporates and causes the monsoon rains that are characteristic climate of that part of the world. Once every 3 or 4 years, for reasons that nobody understands, the monsoons, the trade winds die down, the warm water spreads back out across the Pacific and causes droughts in Asia and Australia, and huge storms in North and South America, and a huge perturbation of the world's weather system. The thermohaline flow is particularly interesting. The waters of the Atlantic flow north. As they flow north, they get colder and also denser because they get saltier because of evaporation. At a point a few hundred kilometers south of Greenland, they become too dense to float and it sinks. The water that sinks there will not emerge again for 1,000 years. It runs back along the Atlantic Ocean, around the tip of South America, into the Indian Ocean, and into the Pacific Ocean, where it emerges again. A small offshoot of that governs the temperature of Western North America and warms it, and another smaller offshoot from this governs the temperature of Europe and warms that. So that has a great deal of effect on our climate system. But by far the most important effect on our climate system is the greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect occurs because the flux of energy from the sun is 343 watts per square meter, averaged over the entire Earth and averaged over an entire year. In pre-industrial times, there was an 88% greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect occurs because the nitrogen and oxygen that make up most of our atmosphere are quite transparent to the white-hot radiation from the sun. But there are trace elements in the atmosphere that are not transparent to the infrared radiation that the Earth tries to radiate back out into space. Water vapor, methane, carbon dioxide, and so on are all greenhouse gases. Those are the gases that trap the radiation that the Earth tries to send back out into space. It re-radiates the energy, some of it back down to the Earth where it warms the Earth, and some of it out into space where it balances the books so that the amount of energy coming in is always equal to the amount of energy going out. But by shining light back down on the Earth, by sending radiation back down on the Earth, it raises the mean temperature of the Earth from 255 kelvins to 287 kelvins, which is 14 degrees Celsius or 57 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that balmy temperature, we evolved, climbed down from the trees, and started building steam engines. There are important feedback effects in all of this. For example, the greenhouse effect in the sun causes the polar caps to melt. The melting of the polar caps reduces the amount of white reflected material and increases the temperature still more. So that's a positive feedback. On the other hand, the melting of the polar caps freshens the northern water. That is, it makes it less salty. And so it threatens to turn around the thermohaline flow, which warms America and Europe, and so that could lead to global cooling. So the whole system is very complicated, much too complicated for a mere physicist like me. So we like to look at limiting cases. There are two limiting cases to look at. One of them is, suppose that there were no greenhouse gases at all, then the temperature of the Earth would immediately drop to 255 kelvins, but that's not the end of it, because at that temperature all the water on the Earth would freeze. The Earth would become much more reflective, and the temperature would drop still more. On the other hand, suppose the 88% greenhouse effect, pre-industrial greenhouse effect, were increased to 100%. What would happen then? We don't know exactly what would happen then, but we have a pretty good model to look at. The planet Venus is a little closer to the sun, so it should be a little bit warmer than the Earth, but that's a very weak effect. It could be very Earth-like in temperature, but we know that it isn't. The Russians dropped a probe to the surface and they found the surface temperature hotter than molten lead. The Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect and a surface temperature that would melt lead. And so looking at these limiting cases, the Earth could be a frozen wasteland, or it could be a Venusian inferno, but it is neither. It's this worldwide Garden of Eden that we have that we must protect. This shows the mean temperature of the Earth in red, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in blue, and the concentration of methane, another greenhouse gas, in green, in parts per billion. The concentration of carbon dioxide is in parts per million. And this goes back over 400,000 years. It's taken from ice cores in the Vostok range. And you see that the temperature tracks the greenhouse gases quite accurately until the last 10,000 years or so. Until the last 10,000 years here, when the temperature settled down at its near its high end, and that's the period during which civilization evolved. What this graph does not show and cannot show is what happened in the last 200 years. In the last 200 years, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up to 380 parts per million. The concentration of methane has just about doubled. And if the temperature follows those trends, the results will be catastrophic indeed. We are doing an uncontrolled experiment with the climate of the only planet we have. It is a very foolish thing to be doing. So before 1800, man lived pretty much entirely on light as it came from the sun. The existence of coal was known, and bits of it were used for space heating and various other uses, but not very much. There were oil seepages at the ground, and so the existence of oil was known, and it was used for various things, but not very much. Swamp gas was known and analyzed by Alessandro Volta around 1800, who discovered that it consisted mostly of methane. So coal, oil, and natural gas were all known to exist, but very little used before 1800. In 1765, a young mechanic named James Watt was fooling around with steam engines trying to repair one when he thought of a better way of making a steam engine. And James Watt's better way of making a steam engine kicked off the Industrial Revolution. By 1800, coal had two effects. One of them was that it was needed for the railroads that were being built. It was needed to drive the railroads. But also, the railroads themselves provided stable roadbeds so that coal could be transported large distances from where it was mined to where it was used. This led to demand for improved illumination. Illumination hadn't changed since antiquity. For a while, whale became very popular for that purpose, but by the middle of the century, the whales were getting scarce and something else was needed. Edwin Drake, a retired railroad conductor, drilled the world's first oil well near Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859. At first, the oil was used for illumination and lubrication, but in 1860, Nicholas Otto, a German entrepreneur, invented the world's first gasoline-burning engine, and soon oil was in great demand for fuel, and oil wells were being dug all over the world. The net result of all of this is that after 150 years, we can no longer live on light as it comes from the sun. We are firmly addicted to oil, and the oil will run out. That's a prediction that I can make with absolute certainty, and so we have a big problem. This graph shows where oil is found on the right-hand side. Two-thirds of the oil in the world, in the world's reserves, are in the Middle East, 10 times as much as in South in Central America, 10 times as much as in Africa, 10 times as much as in the former Soviet Union, North America, Asia, and Europe. In effect, the Middle East is the only player in the game. Nobody else has very much oil at all. The right-hand graph shows the known reserves, proven reserves of oil, in thousands of millions of barrels, that is trillions of barrels. And you can see that in 2001, there was 1 trillion barrels in the ground where we knew where it was, ready to be dug up and used, and that's a good supply. And so we don't seem to have a problem, but that's the wrong way of looking at it. Marion King Hubbert was an oil geologist who in 1956 predicted that North America's oil was soon going to run out. In fact, he predicted that it would start to run out around 1970. He had these data in hand. This is the data for the discovery of oil in the lower 48 states. The exploitation of this oil would come later than the discovery. So this is a bell-shaped curve. There would be a second bell-shaped curve for the production of oil that would be later than this. And he predicted that the maximum, the peak in the production of oil would come around 1970. He was practically laughed out of his profession for making such a ridiculous prediction, but in the event, he turned out to be exactly right. The red curve here shows the kind of curve that Hubbert used to make his prediction. The black points are the experimental points that show the actual production of oil, and you can see that he hit it right on the head. We today have enough information for worldwide oil production to make the same kind of prediction that Hubbard made in 1956 for the US oil production. Various people have made such predictions, but I'll get back to that in a second. This shows the proved oil reserves on the left, and the amount of oil discoveries and production on the right. On the left curve, you see that the proved oil reserves increased dramatically in the late 1980s in OPEC countries. OPEC is the oil producing countries. The amount increased dramatically in the late 1980s. It was not because of any discoveries. You can look on the right-hand curve and see that there were no important discoveries in OPEC countries in the late 1980s. What happened instead was that OPEC changed its quota rules for how much each country could ship, based in part on their proved reserves, and the proved reserves appeared out of nowhere by magic. If you look at the right-hand curve, you see that the production of oil increased above the rate of discovery of oil in around 1980. And for the past 25 years, we've been producing, that is, extracting oil faster than we've been discovering it. That means that the reserve should be going down, but if you look at the left-hand curve, you see the reserves are always going up. So the reserves are very soft numbers. This is political oil, not geological oil. In any case, the graph on the right gives us the information about oil on the global scale of the same kind that Hubbard had about oil on the US scale in 1956. So we should be able to predict when a worldwide peak called Hubbard's peak will occur. This is one such prediction. The red curve is exactly the same curve you saw on the previous graph for worldwide oil production. The lower curves are just partials that add up to the red curve. The oil took a dip in 1973 when Arab countries embargoed oil to take advantage of the fact that the United States no longer had an unlimited supply. And it took another dip in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution. They recovered from both of those dips, but this prediction predicts that there will be another maximum, and that prediction is for right about now. When this maximum occurs, it will not be temporary, it will not be artificial, it will be permanent and forever. And so we will be in deep trouble when this dip occurs. This particular prediction is one among many. As I said, it was made by Colin Campbell and Jean Lauré in 1998. But you have to be a little skeptical about predictions of this sort. For one thing, they used 1.8 trillion barrels as the amount of oil that nature had made for us, the total amount that nature ever made for us. Looking at the data today, about 2 trillion barrels seems to be a more reasonable estimate. That would put off the peak for a little while. New technology is the equivalent of new discovery. It makes more oil available. So that puts off the peak for a little while. The increasing price of oil, the price of oil recently went down again, but it'll go back up again. The increasing price makes more oil available because you can apply more technology to get more oil out. And as we've seen, the reserve numbers, the amount of oil that's on reserve is very soft. It's not very meaningful. And all of those factors make predictions unreliable. Nevertheless, the basic idea of the prediction is right. The oil discovery started from zero. It rises to a maximum that will never be exceeded, and then it declines forever. And we will be in trouble, not when we pump the last drop of oil out of the ground, but when we reach the halfway point, because that's the point of the maximum. That's by symmetry. That's roughly where the maximum will occur. And so when we reach the halfway point in exploiting oil, we will be in deep trouble, and that's a lot sooner than anybody had imagined before. Kenneth DeFays, who is an oil man, said that he realized that Hubbard had been right and that the United States had started to decline in its production of oil when he read the following line in the San Francisco Chronicle in the spring of 1971. the Texas Railroad Commission announced 100% allowable for next month. Now, you have to be an oil man to understand what that means. DeFaze was an oil man. The Texas Railroad Commission was the quaintly named cartel that governed the amount of oil that could be extracted from oil wells in Texas and controlled the amount of oil generally available in the United States by controlling the amount available in Texas. When it announced 100% allowable for next month, it was announcing that it had lost control, that it was no longer keeping a cap on the oil production. The people were free to pump flat out, and the Texas Railroad Commission became irrelevant. OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, was formed immediately after that to do for the world what the Texas Railroad Commission had done for Texas and the United States, that is to control the world supply by controlling the amount that Saudi Arabia could pump. So I've always thought, ever since reading this, that the signal that we had reached a worldwide peak would be that Saudi Arabia had maxed out. And on February 24th, 2004, a story appeared in the New York Times that said exactly that had happened. Forecast of rising oil demand challenges tired Saudi fields by Jeff Gerth. The country's oil fields are now in decline, prompting industry and government officials to raise serious questions about whether the kingdom will be able to satisfy the world's thirst for oil in coming years. Now, this was a New York Times story, so it was very long. And it's written in a style in which each paragraph contradicts the previous paragraph. That's called balanced reporting. And so it goes on to say later on in the story, some economists are optimistic that if oil prices rise high enough, advanced recovery techniques will be applied, averting supply problems. But he takes it back in the very next sentence when he says, but privately some Saudi oil officials are less sanguine, and so on. I don't know whether we will someday look back and say that February 24th, 2007 was the day that Hubbard's Peak was reached. It may be, it may not be. We're much too close to the situation to be able to tell. But to all the people who are aware of the Hubbard's Peak predictions, this was a chilling article indeed. On the other hand, the New York Times on March 5th, 2007 carried an article by a different writer. It's Oil Innovations Pump New Life into Old Wells. It said many oil executives say that peak oil theorists fail to take into account the way that sophisticated technology combined with higher prices makes searching for new oil more affordable. And goes on later on to say, typically oil companies can only produce one barrel for every three they find. This represents a tremendous opportunity. So the crisis may have already occurred. It may not occur for another 10 or 20 years. We can't be sure. We're much too close to the situation to be able to tell. But it will occur. It took the Earth and the Sun hundreds of millions of years to produce the oil that we have. We've used up roughly half of it in about 100 years. That's much too fast. And the oil will run out. And the question is only when. And that's the big question. Oil users, petrochemicals are an important use of oil. There are 6.5 billion people living on the planet today, most of them reasonably well-fed as a result of something called the Green Revolution, which took place in the second half of the 20th century. The Green Revolution consists in large measure of fertilizing land using petrochemical-based fertilizers. Without oil, I don't think we can support the 6.5 billion people alive today, much less the 10 billion people that are expected by the middle of the century. And so we will be in deep trouble. Stationary power plants use oil, but they, in that application, it's easily substituted by nuclear power and by coal, and so that's somewhat less important. Home heating oil is very important for many people, and if the price of oil skyrockets, that will be a grave inconvenience to those people. But by far the most important application of oil is in transportation. Cars, trucks, planes, ships, and trains all run on oil. And it's difficult to see how it can be replaced. This shows global energy consumption in 1998. It hasn't changed all that much since then. The vertical scale is terawatts. On the horizontal, you see oil, gas, and coal. About 5 terawatts worth of oil, 2.5 terawatts of gas, and 2.5 terawatts of coal. 10 terawatts in all of fossil fuels. There are a few other sources of energy. The total is 12.8 terawatts, of which the United States uses 3.3, That's a quarter of the total. With 5% of the world's population, we use a quarter of the total amount of energy. We are profligate users of energy, something that has to stop. 99 quads, that's quadrillion British thermal units. That's a unit you won't hear again in this talk. If we run out of oil, what is there that can replace it? Well, we up to now have been using light crude oil, and there is always so-called heavy oil. That's what's left behind in oil fields after the light crude is pumped out. And you can always pump a little more oil out of any given oil field by applying technology to get at the heavy oil. But the more you pump out, the heavier it gets, and so that's ultimately a losing game. There's also the tar sands and oil sands of Alberta and Venezuela. The tar sands of Alberta were renamed oil sands to attract investment. But it takes 2 tons of strip mined ore to make 1 barrel of a fluid that's not rich enough to distill into gasoline. And so hydrogen must be added. And some of the world's largest plants for converting methane to hydrogen have been built in Alberta. And that's characteristic as you go down this list. As you go down, you find that each thing becomes more inconvenient, and more difficult, and more expensive to use. Natural gas is a good substitute for oil. It can be turned into a liquid fuel, or it can be used in compressed form in cars very much like the ones we drive today. But the worldwide Hubbard's peak for natural gas is only 10 or 20 years behind the worldwide Hubbard's peak for oil, and so that's only a temporary solution at best. Shale oil is unborn oil. Oil was born when organic inclusions sank into the earth to just the proper depth. If it sank too far, it converted into natural gas, where it may have escaped and may not have escaped. But if it didn't sink far enough, it remained behind as shale oil, which was named shale oil to attract investment again. It can be heated in a retort after being strip mined and turned into a fluid that can be turned into gasoline, but that's an extremely expensive and destructive process. And people who have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in shale oil have now sold off their investments because they've concluded that it will always be energy negative. Whether it will always be energy negative, that is, take more energy than it produces, I don't know, but it's a touch and go. It's a close call. Methane hydrate is another form of fuel. It comes into being when methane comes into contact with water near the freezing point under high pressure. Nobody knows how much of it is exists or where it is. But it does exist, and it has been discovered, and nobody knows how it could be mined and used. And then there's coal. We're told that there are hundreds, maybe thousands of years worth of coal in the ground. The fact that the estimates run from hundreds of thousands of years over a factor of 10 tells you that nobody has any idea of how much there is. But even that's accurate compared to the second part of the sentence at the present rate of production. The largest deposits are found in the United States, though there are large deposits in Russia and China as well. It can be liquefied as a substitute for oil. That was done by the Germans during the Second World War. They had coal but no oil, and so they liquefied coal to make oil. But it's a very dirty fuel. It comes combined with mercury, arsenic, sulfur, and various other things that are difficult and expensive to get rid of. It's the worst possible fuel from the point of view of the greenhouse effect, because every molecule of coal that's burned turns into a molecule of carbon dioxide. You have to increase the rate at which it's mined by a factor of 5 to replace the missing oil. We saw in a previous graph that we use about twice as much oil as we use coal in energy, and so you have to make it 3 times as fast for that reason, but the conversion process is always inefficient. And so it would take mining coal on an absolutely unimaginable scale. 100,000 men and boys died in the coal mines of England in the second half of the 19th century alone. So mining coal is a very dangerous business, and mining coal much faster than anybody can imagine mining it today would be very dangerous indeed. That doesn't take into account the increasing population of the world, which would increase the demand for coal, the fact that the poorer parts of the world want to have a higher standard of living and be more like us, and that means using more energy. And if, above all, it doesn't take into account the Hubbert's Peak effect, which is just as valid for coal as it is for oil, we will start running out of coal, I predict, by the end of this century. That is, if we turn to coal as a substitute for oil, we will start running out of all coal by the end of this century. So what does the future hold? Well, one thing is that there will be an oil crisis very soon. I don't know whether very soon, as I said before, I don't know whether very soon means it's already upon us, or it won't be here for another 10 or 20 years. 10 to 20 years is nothing on the scale of human history. It's a matter of whether we or our children or our grandchildren are suffer this the disastrous effects. But on the scale of human history, that's a negligible difference. If we turn to coal to replace the oil, then all fossil fuels will run out by the end of the century. And doing that will have unknown consequences for the climate of the planet, as we've already seen. Nevertheless, if we survive that, then we will be left with only two possible substitutes for oil, that is solar and nuclear. Substituting those two for oil presents tremendous dilemmas that are social and political in nature, and also technical. I can't say very much about the social and political parts of it, but I can say a few words about the technical parts. One suggestion to put off this the problem has been the conservation. Emery Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute wrote an article recently about conservation. He said we can use ultralight strong materials to make our cars so that they burn less gasoline. We can all drive hybrids. I drive a hybrid. I don't see why everybody doesn't. We can make more efficient buildings and factories. We can get fuel from switchgrass and poplar. And I've added sugar cane to his list because sugar cane is the one crop that's actually used to make ethanol for fuel in Brazil. Unfortunately, we don't have the warm enough climate to do it, but the Brazilians do. You can make more efficient use of electricity. You can have fee baits, that is, you charge a fee to gas-burning cars and restore it to people who drive more reasonable models. That's the kind of meddling that our politicians are loath to do, and so on. There are possible technological fixes for the greenhouse effect. One of them is a parasol at L1. L1 is the Lagrange point, about a hundredth of the distance between the Earth and the Sun, where a satellite could stay in orbit with a period of one Earth year. If you put up a large parasol 2,000 kilometers across at L1, it would look like a permanent spot on the face of the sun. It would reduce the flux of energy from the sun by 2% and relieve us of having to worry about global warming. And so we could burn fossil fuel to our heart's content. That is technically a possible thing to do, but it's a very foolish idea. As we've already seen, the Earth's destiny is not governed by the solar flux. It could be a frozen snowball or a Venusian inferno with the same solar flux. And so I don't think that's a very wise thing to do. Another thing is to sequester carbon dioxide. I heard a great deal today about sequestering carbon dioxide. But this is an unproved technology. It hasn't been done on a large scale yet. The verdict of nature awaits us. Solar power is bound to be an important part of our future. We already use solar power in the form of hydroelectric. The enormous pressure at the bottom of a reservoir drives a turbine, which produces electricity. The water runs out, gets evaporated by the sun, and rains back into the onto the land and gathers again in the reservoir, so it's a renewable form of energy. Unfortunately, we've built hydroelectric dams pretty much everywhere we can, so we can't build new hydroelectric dams to replace the missing fuel, so that will not solve our problems. Wind has become increasingly popular. And it may be an important source of energy, for example, in Northern Europe, where the wind is strong and and fuel is expensive, but it's too intermittent and too undependable to be a good substitute for coal. And so it will always contribute, but not very much, to our problems. Biomass, we've already mentioned biomass when discussing Avery Lovins. That was how we lived up until 200 years ago. The problem with biomass is that it's inefficient. Only about 1/10 of 1% of the sunlight falling on the land gets converted to chemical potential energy by biomass. Much better is photovoltaics. Photovoltaics contribute about 10% of the energy that falls on the land and made into electrical energy. The trouble with photovoltaics is that it would take 220,000 square kilometers of photovoltaics to make the 10 terawatts of fossil fuel that we use today. So if we decided to kick the fossil fuel habit and turn to solar energy, we would have to cover 220,000 square kilometers with photovoltaics. That's about half the size of the state of California. It's not an impossibly large area to conceive of covering, but all of the photovoltaics made up to the present time would probably cover no more than 10 square kilometers. So 200,000 square kilometers is a very tall order, almost unimaginable. In Scientific American magazine in December 16th of 2007, a solar grand plan was presented, which allowed us to replace 15 terawatts of energy by solar power by the year 2050 if we got cracking on starting to do it immediately, but we haven't gotten cracking on starting to do it. Nobody is doing it. Nuclear energy will always be an important part of our energy mix. Geothermal energy is nuclear because the interior of the Earth is heated by the decay of natural radioactivity. Geothermal sources are used for space heating and water heating in various places, but using it for power is much more difficult. There are only a few places in the world where a geothermal source comes close enough to the surface to be used for power generation, and it's pretty much used there. So it will always be a contributor to our power needs, but never a major one. Fission is the kind of nuclear energy that we've been using up to now, and it could be expanded to take up some of the slack. 10 terawatts, that's the amount of fossil fuel that we've seen that we use, would require 10,000 gigawatt plants. A gigawatt is about the biggest plant you can make, and building 10,000 of them, none have been built in the United States in the past 20 years or in Canada for the past 20 or 30 years, but there are people seeking licenses to build them now, and so 30 or 40 may be built in the future, but not 10,000. And so that is not a solution. Fusion is the kind of energy that is used in the H-bomb and in the sun, and it is a possible solution. 1 gallon of seawater contains enough deuterium to replace 300 gallons of gasoline. So if you could conquer fusion energy, control fusion energy, you would have enough energy for all of our needs. The problem is that fusion has been 25 years in the future for the past 50 years and still 25 years in the future. So fusion energy is definitely the energy source of the future and always will be. Transportation can't run on solar power or nuclear power. There won't be any solar or nuclear cars anytime soon. So that's a problem, but advanced batteries can propel cars. Hydrogen. All the talk about a hydrogen economy is largely blather. It takes 6 gallons of gasoline equivalent to make enough hydrogen to replace 1 gallon of gasoline. So it's a poor bet at present, but in some future time when we have all the fusion energy we need, you could electrolyze water to make hydrogen and use the hydrogen to make fuel, either use it directly in hydrogen fuel cells or as internal combustion engines, or to make other fuels, combined with carbon dioxide to make a fuel, for example. So the point is we understand the basic principles that would be necessary to form a civilization as complex as ours without fossil fuels, but nobody is doing anything about it. In the 2008 State of the Union Address, our former president said, to To build a future of energy security, we must trust in the creative genius of American researchers and entrepreneurs and empower them to pioneer a new generation of clean energy technology. Our security, our prosperity, and our environment all require reducing our dependence on oil. So even our former president was aware of the problem, if dimly, but he had no important suggestions about what to do about the problem. The problem still lingers. Scientists are supposed to make predictions. And you analyze a situation and you make a prediction about what will happen if you change something. And you hope your prediction is right because that will show how smart you are. And you don't believe that making the prediction has anything to do with whether it turns out to be right or not. That should be independent. I have a prediction to make. First, let me show you this picture. It's a picture of the United States on 14th of August, 2003, when a great portion of New England was knocked out by a power line falling on a tree in Ohio. If that much of New England could be knocked out by such an event, we live in a dangerously interdependent society, and we are vulnerable at all times. So let me get to my prediction. My prediction is that civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century when the fuel runs out. I hope that I'm wrong, and I hope that making the prediction will help to make me wrong because some of you will go out and work on this problem. I thought for a long time about what I could do about this problem, what I could do to contribute to the solution of this problem. I don't know anything very useful. I'm just a physicist, so I couldn't think of anything to do. But I decided that what I could do was to write a book about it, and I have written a book, and I thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Professor Goodstein, for a very fascinating and maybe a little bit depressing presentation. I'm sure we would like to take any questions from... See, everyone's just depressed now. I feel bad because I have no gas in my car. I'm going to go fill up on the way home. I'm not walking. Oh, okay, good.
I don't think we know what Obama has in mind. His heart seems to be in the right place. He's an improvement for the United States, but I don't know what he has in mind for this problem or whether he's even aware of this problem. Yes, yes. He certainly wants to decrease the amount of greenhouse gases we put out. And he may succeed in doing that. Whether 2050 is soon enough, I don't know.
I had one question about the idea of using biomass. I mean, biomass seems to be the only thing that scales with our own population. So it seems to be something that maybe we should consider more seriously. But
well, as I said, the biomass is very inefficient, and so you have to convert a great deal of the arable land in the country to growing fuel instead of food, and that would be a disaster for our people who want to eat. So
well, then we can't all eat, then there's less meat. Any other questions? Gabriel?
I'd like to make a contrarian observation, which is it's just a historical comment. There have been in the past predictions of such disasters. The one that comes to my mind is associated with the name of Malthus, which was based on the rate at which population grows, and I forget what else. And they didn't come to pass. So even though I can't say anything substantive on the arguments that you presented, it may be that in the future people, the population may decrease and people will be more efficient at not squandering energy, and things may come out all right. But of course, it's just a matter of time. Eventually, there will be a disaster because it's impossible to keep on going forever. But it's a question of when, isn't it?
Yes, I agree. It's a question of when. This is a lot like the story of the little boy who cried wolf. And nobody paid any attention to him anymore because he cried wolf. What people forget about that story is at the end of the story, the wolf does appear. And the wolf will appear in this case as well. But I don't know when. You're quite right about that.
Have you estimated the sustainable population of the Earth, assuming we have a standard of living and just using the sunlight?
I think probably 2.5 billion people might be a sustainable population for the Earth, but not 6.5 billion people.
So I just wanted to clarify your comment about wanted to understand your point about coal, actually. So I've read many places that the reserves can last us hundreds of years, but is your argument that we don't have the means to mine it at the scale that current civilization requires, and that's why we'll run out of this source of energy?
Well, you're talking about coal?
Yes.
Yeah. If we did have the means of mining it five times faster than we're mining it now, it would run out all the sooner. And so it's the devil's game. If we mine it very fast, it will run out very fast.
Can you comment on the efficiency with which we use energy, given the current price, which you pointed out at the start? It's very inexpensive, and therefore we're very wasteful in our use of all forms of energy. How much energy would we really need if we were careful?
Well, we need a lot less energy than we use in the United States at present. But I don't know how much we would need. I have no firm estimate of that.
Can you make some comparison between, because you said nuclear was one example, but we'd need a vast expansion of the amount of power stations. Solar is an example, but we'd need a vast expansion. We'd need a vast expansion of the land that was covered with these panels. So in view of the costs associated with nuclear for storage and safety and things like that, what's your view of what direction?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you're saying.
Oh, yeah, is the microphone not close enough? That's what you're saying. Yeah. So I was just saying that you said something about nuclear power and something about solar power, and both of these things would need vast expansion in order to cover the energy loss, the energy that we'll need to replace. But I was just wondering what your view of which direction we should go in view of the, you know, the safety concerns, but also the cost of storage of spent fuel and things like that with on the nuclear side. So
I think we have to try everything. We have to try everything as well as we possibly can. Everything will come with problems. Nuclear energy comes with problems of waste, nuclear waste. But that's not an insoluble problem. It's a technical problem, and we're very good at solving technical problems. We have to try nuclear. We have to try biomass. We have to try everything and hope that we can somehow substitute for the oil before the oil runs out.
So with the Hubbert's Peak model, basically the trouble comes when worldwide production of any commodity starts to drop, right?
Yes.
Are there any commodities known where that's actually already happened? And if so, what were the consequences? Like any finite resource like copper or gold or whatever, or is production at this point of everything we know still
increasing? There probably are such materials, but I don't know. I'm not an expert, and I don't know what they are.
To
to suggest a response to the former question, probably whale oil was the victim of a Hubbard Peak, and that's why we no longer extract it from whales or use it, just if I had to guess. What I'm interested in, though, is the idea of putting a parasol at Lagrange Point 1. Is there any means to keep it there, or will solar wind inevitably blow it out of its orbit and send it careening off in an unknown direction?
We're very good at putting things into orbit and keeping them there in spite of the solar wind and various other perturbations. So I think it would be possible to keep it there, but it's not a very good idea. Well, because just putting up a parasol to reduce the energy of the sun will be a very wasteful thing in the future when we need as much energy from the sun as we can get. It's true. It's true.
Okay, well, maybe we'll just stop the questioning here, and we're going to have a wine and cheese reception upstairs in the bistro on the fourth floor. And so we can continue the discussion there. Hopefully it'll be more upbeat and less depressing. And I'd like everybody to thank Professor Gustin again for a very fascinating talk.